Hey everyone, it's Luke here with a little bonus content for you today. We don't do enough Canadian content on the show, so I'm hoping we can rectify that, or at least partly rectify it with this recording. So last weekend, for context, Canadians in the province of British Columbia, which is Canada's westernmost and third largest province, went to the polls, yielding what I think can safely be called a startling result. The NDP, which is the main social democratic party in Canada, it's had a tenuous hold on power since it formed a minority government in the province in 2017, and it won a landslide victory this weekend on a scale that's really never been seen before in British Columbia. So it's a pretty major political event in the Canadian context, and I didn't want to let it pass without talking about it a bit. So to discuss all of this, I'm joined by the writer David Moskrop. David is a political scientist who himself happens to be a British Columbian, and he is also a columnist at the Washington Post. David, welcome. Did I miss anything in that introduction?
Well, technically I'm now a former BCer, but they grandfather you in, you know. You get, it's like lifetime membership.
Where are you based these days?
I'm in Ottawa at the moment. Although funny enough, trying desperately to get back to British Columbia. So I left BC when I finished my PhD to do a 2-year postdoc here after a decade in British Columbia. And I'm working on getting back really soon. And you know what the one thing that is holding me back at the moment is? It isn't the pandemic. It's housing prices. Rental prices, and so, which was a huge topic during the election. But so the British Columbia politics is, I would say, the politics I pay the closest attention to, not only because it's inherently interesting, but because I have a little bit of a horse in that race.
Right. And I've always found BC politics interesting. I've had an interest in them since I was a student of Canadian political science myself, but also at my previous job at the Broadbent Institute and reporting for Press Progress. We did a lot of work on BC. So I have a kind of, I don't know, for an Ontarian anyway, a sort of weirdly granular knowledge of like particular ridings in BC and things like that, and particular characters. BC politics, I think more than any other province, produces, should we say, distinctive personalities who stand out in your mind, and maybe we'll get to a few of those. But let's begin by talking a bit about what happened. So the NDP formed a majority government. The results as they stand have the NDP at 55 seats, which you need 44 seats for a majority in BC, about 45% of the popular vote for the NDP. The Liberals are at 29 seats, about 35% of the popular vote. And then the only other party that won seats are the Green Party. They had 3 seats going in. They won 3 seats this weekend with about 15% of the vote. The election was a little bit odd because of all the votes coming in from mail-in ballots. So the election has been called, but there are, correct me if I'm wrong, about 500,000 more, or a little more than 500,000 more ballots to count. How long is that going to take?
Yeah, so first of all, a little correction on my end. I think it was in BC about 8 or 9 years. I don't want to get, you know, fact-checked into oblivion.
A lot of pedants listen to this show, so I'm sure they're gonna do their opposition research before they listen. But glad to set the record straight.
British Columbia had an extraordinary growth in mail-in ballots requested. It was something like 700,000 mail-in ballots were requested, and something like 500,000 were returned, which is some, I don't know what the growth is on the 2017 election, but it was like 7,000% or something like that. It was through the roof. And by law in British Columbia, you have to wait 13 days after the election to count the mail-in ballots, because they want to check it against local lists to make sure nobody voted in person and by mail-in ballot. So it's a fraud check, which is entirely reasonable and usually doesn't matter, because you're talking like 6,500 mail-in ballots or something like that. But now you're talking hundreds of thousands because of the pandemic. So they're checking them. However, because of the sort of range of the BC NDP's dominance and the across ridings, but also the dominance within them, networks were comfortable calling a BC majority pretty much an hour into the count.
Yeah, so let's talk about the scale of the NDP's win, because I think here, you know, that really is kind of the story. I mean, BC, I think it's fair to say, more than any other province in Canada, is a place where the right has historically been dominant. For those who don't know, outside of Ontario and Quebec, which is kind of its own party system for kind of local reasons, being a Francophone province, et cetera. Two-party systems are pretty common throughout Canada. You know, most provinces, you know, Atlantic Canada tends to be, and I can think of only one exception to this, a Liberal Party and a Conservative Party. In Atlantic Canada, traditionally, the parties aren't even very ideologically distinct. They're just kind of these somewhat arbitrary political identities, and they trade power every decade or so. On the prairies, sort of west of Ontario, things are a little different. Prairies have a much more populist political culture. And so the prairies are where Canadian socialism, the social gospel, the kind of movements that created Canadian socialism were born. And in the 90s, they were also, the 80s and 90s, they were also kind of the center of sort of a right-wing reaction against the central Canadian liberal establishment. So they gave us the Reform Party, later the Canadian Alliance, and also the right-wing premierships of people like Ralph Klein in Alberta and a few others. So that's kind of the dynamic in those provinces. And BC is really no exception. And it's a place where, in fact, liberals and conservatives have effectively formed a sort of permanent coalition designed to keep the NDP and before them the CCF out of power. So, David, can you give us a little bit of a history of, I mean, going back as far as you want, of kind of BC electoral politics? When have the NDP been in power, and what have their, compared to the BC Liberals and before that Social Credit, which came before the BC Liberals, what have their tenures, what has the NDP's tenure in power looked like?
Well, I mean, BC at times looked like a one-party state, a little bit like Alberta, right? Because the conservative dominance in Alberta was probably truly the most extraordinary in Canada, and in Ontario for a time too, although it's much more competitive now. But in British Columbia, the NDP fortunes have been pretty limited. In fact, Horgan, unless we're super, super pedantic and technical about it, Horgan is the first BC NDP premier to win re-election in the province's history, right? There's some caveats and parliamentary not whatever in there, but that's close enough for jazz, you know? And the last time, it's been over 20 years since the NDP's formed government. And so they were looking like in 2013, they were headed for a win, to the point where there was a headline in the province, the newspaper of the province, that said, in reference to the BC NDP leader at the time, Adrian Dix, this man could kick a dog and still win the election. Never mind the stupid framing of that, but it, you know, he was so far ahead, and he ended up losing to a Liberal majority. And so the Liberals have dominated British Columbia politics for decades. Before that, the Socreds did. And so the NDP spent a lot of time in the wilderness. The recent history of BC politics was the coalition you're talking about, which is often referred to as the quote unquote free enterprise coalition, insert groan here. And it was effectively made up of, you know, a mix, as you mentioned, of conservatives and liberals, who of the old sort of so-cred conservative, socially conservative types, and a bunch of free market liberals who sort of hijacked the branding and the name and produced this BC Liberal Party. And that was a sort of uncomfortable coalition, as of, again, of social conservatives and business-minded centrists, that's been able to hold for a long time. But British Columbia, up until the NDP won in 2017, had very little rules on campaign and political finance, very few rules. It was known as, I mean, the New York Times ran a piece calling BC the Wild West of money and politics. Like, if an American publication is saying you've got a money and politics problem, you've got a real serious money and politics problem, right? But the BC NDP changed that. So this was the first election where the influence of money from corporations, from foreign entities and individuals, from other provinces, from unions, was effectively muted. So there's been a long transformation along that axis. And then also, the province has been developing demographically too. And so one of the things is that, you know, for a long time, British Columbia was sort of, you know, predominantly rural, and that's been changing quite a bit and continues to change, and certainly more diverse than it used to be. And so there are a lot of transformations happening around the province, both electorally in terms of the rules and the coalitions that are governing, but also demographically. And so you saw some really serious flips in this election that indicate not only is the BC NDP changing, but the ridings are changing too.
Yeah, I think the real tell for me was the riding of Vancouver Falls Creek, which until the weekend was held by Sam Sullivan, who's the former right-wing mayor of Vancouver. And as I think, even by BC standards, it's fair to say, a bit of an ideologue. He ran for the BC Liberal leadership unsuccessfully. And I remember one of the things I heard him talk about was the privatization of healthcare, right? Mm-hmm. Which even in the BC Liberal Party is very much a kind of a third rail. So when I saw that he was trailing in Vancouver Falls Creek, I knew that the BC Liberal goose was cooked. And I think the networks called it not long after they first broadcast that result. So let's talk about, it's amazing that the two parallels to American politics have already come up here. So one is that I think BC is possibly a bit of a preview of what may happen in the United States next week. There's been a lot of, justified concern about mail-in ballots and the possibility that one candidate in particular will be kind of sowing a lot of doubt about the legitimacy of the mail-in ballots and stuff like that on election night. But if the margin, the lesson I think from BC is if the margin is large enough, that may not even matter. The networks may be able to call things, and that'll just be, a few days will go by and they'll keep counting, and the same trend will hold. But you also mentioned campaign financing. And I think we should just spend a little bit of time on just how crazy BC's campaign finance system was. Something that was allowed under party financing law in British Columbia until these rule changes by the NDP. A scandal that afflicted the former Liberal Premier, Christy Clark, involved her being paid a salary by the BC Liberal Party for work she was doing to attend fundraisers with that were like essentially cash for access fundraisers with large companies in BC. She was paid a salary by the party in addition to her premier's salary for what was essentially companies just buying access to the most powerful person in the province and her personally profiting from these relationships. That's one example that occurs to me. I mean, what else can be said? What else do you think needs to be said about how crazy BC's Wild West of political financing was?
Well, I mean, again, parties could accept until 2017, 2018. I think the rules came into effect in 2018. The BC NDP formed government in 2017. Parties could accept unlimited money, corporate money, union money, foreign money. There was just no, anybody could give you whatever they wanted. And of course, a certain amount of anonymous money as well. And so people could just shovel you all the cash you wanted. It didn't matter. They were just, there were election limits, right? I mean, so in defense of the system a little bit, actually not defense because it was indefensible, some nuance to it, was that just because you had all the money in the world prior to the election didn't mean you could spend it all during the election. But of course, we know that electoral periods, while discrete, are affected by the period that precedes it, right? So if you're doing a bunch of ad spending and recruitment work ahead of the election, you're electioneering, right? And if you've got unlimited money to do that, then all of a sudden, you've got an advantage. And the BC Liberals had a huge advantage for a long time on that. So, but I mean, again, the idea that you could just take unlimited money, including foreign money, for a lot of people is utterly bonkers, and I think appropriately so. So, the NDP really clamped down on that. And that's the norm across the country now. I mean, it's not universal, but, it was sort of set federally back in the 90s by a liberal, by Jean Chrétien and the Liberals. And then it's sort of been creeping across the country ever since. I think Quebec, for instance, has some of the most stringent rules. There were also changes to the amount of donations individually in BC as well, and that stuff was all indexed. So, I mean, again, that's increasingly the norm, although in some places, for instance, Saskatchewan, who's got an election right now, they're still holding out. But again, I just think the idea that, unlimited money can be coming from anywhere and that's politics, shows you how, you know, quote unquote, Wild West BC was. But no more.
And it's a Wild West in other senses as well, because I think more so than any other province, BC has been prone to a particular type of, well, to scandals, but also scandals of a particularly strange and often bizarre kind. I mean, it's low-hanging fruit, but if you go back to the 19th century, BC literally had a premier called Amour de Cosmos. Yeah. More recently... a scandal that it seemed like was probably going to topple the liberal hegemony, which was this, you have to remind me of the date, but this kind of the quick win scandal, as it's colloquially referred to, where basically documents were leaked from within the BC Liberal government, which showed that they were planning a number of historical apologies to particular communities in the province, to achieve quote unquote quick wins ahead of a provincial election. And there are so many other scandals we could talk about. I remember many years ago when he was running for the NDP leadership, the federal NDP MP, who's actually just been elected in the NDP landslide in BC, Nathan Cullen, when he came to the University of Toronto and I hosted him there, I remember his description of BC politics was, it's like yours, only crazier. So I don't know, what do you think can be said about this particular quality in BC politics, and where does it come from? I mean, I am loath to ascribe things to culture, but we're speaking kind of more broadly here about, culture is ultimately materially rooted. And I'm wondering if you think there are particular dynamics in British Columbia that have produced this kind of strange history of scandals and sort of bizarre gaffes on the part of politicians and elected officials.
Yeah, I mean, Bingo Gate, Fast Ferries. I mean, we saw the BC Liberals in this campaign have a couple of real humdingers around candidates saying outrageous things that, you know, I mean, things they believed, obviously. They said them unironically, as far as I can tell. I don't really know what it is about BC politics. I think if you were to dig into Quebec politics, you'd find a lot of crazy stuff as well. There's a long history of that. It pops up in Ontario politics from time to time. But I do think, in part, in British Columbia, it is a function of complacency on the part of parties that tend to have a lot of resources and win a lot. I think, you know, a lot of times when you see scandals emerge, it's a function of parties thinking they can get away with things, right? And often getting away with them indeed, right? And that's a huge problem, is if parties aren't being sanctioned, if people aren't being sanctioned routinely for these missteps, then they're just going to keep happening because there's no incentive or reason to stop. And again, the rules in BC were often unclear and lax for a long time. And so, you know, there was a lot of daylight between, I think, what was appropriate behavior and what people thought they could get away with. And they sort of just kept repeating it. I have a feeling, and of course, I mean, look at the money laundering in British Columbia. There's a huge inquiry right now being led by the NDP. It was on hold for the election, but it's kicking back up soon, into money laundering in the province that was going through the province's casinos, the provincial run casinos that was laundering foreign money and drug money and so on and so forth. Right. And I mean, again, look at the province and say, in what world do you get away with that? But they just kept getting away with it because no one was doing anything about it. I'll say this about the NDP. I think the NDP who had problems and scandals of their own are one of the more disciplined bunches the province has seen in a long time, maybe ever. And they're interested in cleaning up that mess too. And so it took them a while to launch the inquiry into money laundering, but they did it eventually. And I think they're taking it seriously. That's my sense. So I do think this new party is less complacent, more disciplined. Of course, they've moved center. We can get into that. But nonetheless, they are taking aim at that long history of scandal, I think.
Yeah, so let's get into kind of the character of the NDP. I mean, for non-Canadian listeners, I think it's worth underscoring that, the NDP actually, unlike the Liberal and Conservative parties, is an integrated party. Like, if you're a member of the NDP, you're a member in whatever province you live in, which kind of dates from the founding of the NDP. and was part of the kind of the effort to create like a mass national working class party. But with that said, the character of different new democratic parties in each province, I mean, it really varies. Some kind of do tend towards more the center. In Manitoba, for example, the NDP was in power for a very long time. And I don't know, though Manitoba NDP partisans might quibble with this, I mean, I don't think that its form of governance was all that distinct from the Liberals in Ontario, for example. You know, the NDP is federally is often very different. It's, I would say, often quite, you know, to the left of particular provincial parties. It's kind of provincial sister parties. It really varies by province. And the BC NDP itself has a bit of an interesting history in this regard, because one of its few terms in government was in the 70s under Premier Dave Barrett, who might be the most left-wing premier ever elected anywhere in Canada. His contemporaries in the 90s, Mike Harcourt and God, I'm forgetting the name of who was the other guy? Mike Harcourt, briefly Ujjal Dusanjh.
Dusanjh was there, and
there's one I forget. Glenn Clark. Okay. Well, I can't. No one can make fun of me for this, because it took David a second, and he actually is from British Columbia. So they were a little more of the centrist variety. I mean, how would you characterize the NDP under John Horgan? You know, what are some of the things it's done in government, and kind of where exactly? How would you place it on the political spectrum?
Because British Columbia is effectively a two-party system, you have a sort of left-right distinction between the two parties, but within a fairly, a moderately narrow ideological band, right? I mean, I moved to British Columbia in 2010. I mean, I spent, again, 9 years or something like that kicking around, paying close attention to that politics. And in that time alone, you could see the ideological bandwidth sort of narrow, because the NDP wanted to be competitive, and there was a sense that they had to prove that they were responsible. And even Horgan and the NDP formed government in 2017, but they did it with fewer seats and fewer votes than the Liberals. And I think they did it because they ended up getting the support of the Greens, largely because of Sonia Firstina, who didn't want to work with the Liberals. And so you kind of saw the NDP move center and have to prove themselves as responsible, quote unquote, and business friendly. And Horgan himself is a New Democrat in the mold of a sort of resource friendly New Democrat. And so the BC NDP, for instance, they raised social assistance rates in some cases. They are pursuing $10 a day childcare. They're trying to clean up money laundering. They got money out of politics, that sort of thing. But they also provided extraordinary tax subsidies to LNG. They're also building a boondoggle of a dam, Site C, which is mired in controversy. Day by day, we see more and more. And you know, there's a carbon tax in British Columbia, but that was brought in by Liberals. and the NDP's green plan is not nothing. It's the sort of like standard green stuff that you see. But it isn't Green New Deal stuff, right? It's not particularly ambitious. They're not getting particularly aggressive on taxes. They're not talking about nationalization of anything. They're not really talking about, you know, the facilitating worker-owned enterprises or anything like that. So they're social democrats in a sort of like centrist variety. But again, I mean, that is the path, and you see this in Alberta as well. That is the path that New Democrats seem to think they need to take to win. My pushback on that is they don't really know that to be the case. They just sort of think that's the case. And so you'll see, I think, with this NDP, more of the same, though, broadly speaking, with the majority. You know, I would love to see them take this majority out for a ride, but I don't think they will. But that doesn't really mean that they're not much better than the Liberals, because plainly they are. It doesn't mean they're not doing important things. I also, you know, Horgan has been pushing hard for drug decriminalization and leaning on the federal government for that. And, you know, the party takes pharmacare seriously as well. So there's some encouraging things in there. But again, they are a sort of restrained NDP, of the sort of contemporary centrist variety, third way-ish, you know, in some senses, but they're no Dave Barrett. You know, I mean, Barrett was a nationalizing force. He was a socialist proper, and that hasn't been true of the NDP for some time. And I don't think it will be true for some time, with one caveat, that the pandemic has, I think, further pushed this idea that, you know, the hysteria around deficits is silly and unnecessary. I think that's also true. And so I think the NDP has some room to get away with running deficits that they might not otherwise have been able to do. Because BC is obsessed with balanced budgets, in part because they've been primed to be by the Liberals for 20 years.
Right, right. Yeah, and I mean, I suppose, I am not in the habit of apologizing for centrist behavior on the part of NDP politicians, but I do think the particular kind of right-wing bent of BC for the last 20 or 30 years probably has a lot of NDP strategists very skittish about, you know, the kinds of things they can get away with. And yep. I remember following... I watched the election results in 2013 and just being like watching in absolute horror, this was one of those elections where, you know, that really shook people's faith in pollsters. And it was deeply scary for, NDP strategists and activists themselves, because they really thought they had the thing in the bag. Mm-hmm. The NDP has undergone a lot of defeats in BC, a lot of kind of unexpected and particularly traumatic defeats. And I think that has probably played a role in, those kinds of defeats are often, parties think often, it makes the internal cultures of political parties more conservative. I mean, that is one of the roots of the kind of third way-ish tendency that you mentioned, in its original location, which was the Labour Party in Great Britain after Thatcherism, right? So, that kind of trauma often yields a kind of, it can often be the harbinger of a kind of a rightward or centrist shift. But I don't think we should we shouldn't exaggerate the parallels between the NDP and something like New Labour in BC or even Alberta, because as you pointed out, there is this other dynamic at play, which is natural resource politics, and the fact that in Alberta, a huge number of the jobs, which was governed until recently by the NDP, and actually may well be governed again by the NDP in the future, if you look at the polls. Pipelines and the oil industry play such a large role there that at least it was believed by the NDP that they couldn't sort of mothball the oil sands or anything like that, or they couldn't they pushed hard on other things. They implemented a $15 an hour minimum wage. They did things like that. But as in the BC example you gave, they basically didn't butt heads with private industry in key ways. This is one of the places where federally and provincially different parts of the NDP are kind of at odds. How would you characterize the campaign that has just happened? What was the election about, if anything? I mean, this was a bit of a strange election given the pandemic and everything, and the election call, which was an early election call, was initially, it seemed, going to be kind of controversial. Obviously the gamble paid off, but I mean, how would you characterize the campaign?
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's funny staring at the federal NDP. I mean, you mentioned the party is federated in a way that no other party is, and you could see that tension play out. For instance, you know, the Alberta NDP supported the expansion of the TMX pipeline. The federal Liberals were in favor of it. The BC NDP actually opposed that one and went to war in some senses with their provincial cousins. And while the federal NDP was put in a really awkward position of not knowing what to do. I mean, poor Jagmeet Singh, what do you do, right? When you've got to oppose the federal government, but you've got internal squabbling with the NDP too. And they've, you know, they ended up losing that battle, sort of, we'll see. But the election itself, I was nervous about it when it was called, and I thought it was unnecessary because of the pandemic. And I was worried about a couple of things. One of them was safety. That concern seems not to have played out. So I think I was mistaken about that. Another, though, was low turnout, which seems to have played out. The turnout seems to be quite low, you know, hovering around 50, 52%, but it's often low in British Columbia anyway. It's routinely in the 50s in BC turnout. And the third was, you know, distracting government from dealing with the pandemic. But ultimately, I think the election itself was about the competence of the NDP versus the utter lackluster performance by the BC Liberals and the fact that they were offering very little, aside from a desperate plan to cut the provincial sales tax for a year or so and then sort of slowly reintroduce it. You know, when your big idea is like a 3% tax cut on consumption taxes, maybe you don't have a lot of big ideas. You know what I mean? And it was sort of like classic neoliberal pablum. But the New Democrats were seen as competent. So the election was about whether or not they were competent. The answer was yes. They were seen as good governors. The answer again, yes. And ultimately, I think it was a question of who do you want managing the pandemic now and the recovery later? And again, voters have been told to be scared of the NDP in BC for a long time. But you know what? That might have resonated in 2009, 2010, whatever, 2013, even a little bit in 2017, because again, the Liberals had more votes and seats. But it didn't in 2020. And the NDP has done a pretty strong job of managing the pandemic and seems to have a plan going forward. And that's, you know, credit to them, credit to Adrian Dix, who was the leader who lost in 2013, who has become an extraordinary health minister, credit to Dr. Bonnie Henry, public health officer, who's done a strong job there too. So, you know, insofar as elections are ever about anything at all, I think this one was about whether or not the NDP had done a good job governing to date and whether they could manage the pandemic and the recovery. And most people said yes. But one caveat, elections are also about what the alternative is. And looking at the BC Liberals, they were an utter joke. I mean, that party is a total mess. It's a teardown job. Their leader, Andrew Wilkinson, who's a doctor, by the way, I say that because he routinely reminds people of that, was just an utter mess. And I would be very surprised if he's not gone within the next couple of weeks or month or so, because he was a mess. And that party needs to rethink a lot of things, including what it's about and how it's going to appeal to a province that's changing. Because one of the sort of cleavages that a lot of people were pointing out in this election was urban versus rural and the changing nature of that dynamic. And I don't know if the BC Liberals are built for that sort of thing. Because they're not only are they losing in metro areas, now they've started losing in rural areas too. I think they've got one MLA, member of the legislature, from the Metro Vancouver area now. The leader, Andrew Wilkinson. So, you know, I mean, it might be two, but I think it's just one. And because Sam Sullivan, who in Falls Creek, that says something. If you can't win seats in the most populous city in the province and the metro area of that city, like, are you equipped to govern? I don't think so. And well, they've got no one on the island, on Vancouver Island.
Right, right. So I, you know, this is kind of where I want to, you know, kind of take the discussion to sort of close this out here, because, you know, I think it's fair to say both of us are happy about the election result with you know, some caveats that we've mentioned. But, you know, what's always fascinated me about BC is the right more than the left, or more than the parliamentary left, the NDP. Because I think there is something distinctive about BC political culture that makes it very difficult to kind of put your finger on. It's very difficult to explain to somebody who isn't familiar with it the strange character of political culture in BC, particularly as it concerns the right. I think the closest analog is probably Australia. And I mean, there are some parallels. They were both settled around the same time by British people in the 19th century. And I think, you know, they both kind of forged their, you know, original identities as sort of frontier settlements of the British Empire. And there are other parallels that really, you know, I think hold in the present. I mean, we've talked about the so-called Free Enterprise Coalition, the BC Liberals, and before that, Social Credit. But Australia also has, you know, a party system that's almost identical. I mean, there technically are, there are kind of three major parties, the Labour, and then also the Nationals and the Liberals. But the Nationals and the Liberals are essentially a permanent coalition. And so Australia has very much the same kind of divide. I think one thing that would be that's particularly strange if you're looking at the BC Liberals and you're an outsider to the province is the fact that the BC Liberals, at least when they were in government and kind of officially anyway on paper, are more kind of socially inclusive than you would expect from like an equivalent you know, a Republican party in the states, a state level Republican party. So it combines this very strange kind of chamber of commerce ethos with this like stereotypical West Coast kind of hippie, like yuppie sort of, you know, Lululemon was literally, that was invented in BC. So, I mean, the only equivalences I can think of are in, you know, parts of the United States that are very geographically close to BC, like Washington State. But I don't know.
California
as well. I mean, what can you say about, what can you say about this in BC? What would you say, how would you characterize the political culture and kind of the strangeness, particularly of the politics on the right, which I think are a bit strange compared to the politics on the right elsewhere?
Yeah, BC is weird. I mean, it's weird because it is a big, diverse province. You've got the sort of like retirees and hippies on Vancouver Island. You've got the sort of like tech bro-y, yuppie, urban champagne socialists in Vancouver. But then you've got, you know, a Bible Belt. You've got an extraordinarily conservative Bible Belt. You've got a lot of new Canadians who live in the suburbs of the greater Vancouver area who are conservative, right? You'll recall that one of the federal conservative strategies in Canada was to court new Canadians who were culturally, or who were rather socially conservative. And that was what former minister, federal minister Jason Kenney, and now Premier of Alberta, was tasked with doing and did extraordinarily well. Because people sort of like, this is a weird thing in Canadian politics where people sort of assume that all new Canadians are the same and they're progressive and so on and so forth, when a lot of them are quite conservative, right? So British Columbia has a mix of all different sorts of folks in different places. And so the right coalition is trying to sort of deal with what the federal conservatives are trying to deal with as well, which is the pro-business types, the sort of like quote-unquote fiscally conservative types, and the socially conservative types who don't always fit together well. And you saw that come out in the scandal with one candidate, Lori Thronis, who was ejected from the party during the election from the BC Liberals for his comments on eugenics and access to birth control. And, you know, and candidates in the past, the BC Liberals have had problems in the with folks and how they've spoken about LGBTQ plus issues, right? This sort of creeps up on them all the time. And again, the right in the province, I think, has decided that they're going to have to just find a way to band together to win. And that they've been able to sort of like manage those cleavages for some time because, you know, winning is a good incentive to hang together, right? The question will be, what happens when you start to lose? The BC Liberals have not lost two elections in a row until now. And now they have. And if the NDP keeps this up, it could very well be that the BC Liberals lose three in a row. And, you know, what happens to your coalition, tenuous as it may be, when you start losing and when money is out of politics, right? They're not going to have the bank accounts they used to have in the party, and they may not be winning the elections they used to win. What do you do then? So I think, you know, the right has been able to cobble together a coalition because it served them well and they were winning. And it was the sort of the folks that we've described. But they might start losing now. So it'll be one thing to watch whether or not a leader can come along. I don't think it'll be Wilkinson. I think it'll be someone after him who can keep that coalition together, or whether or not there'll be sort of a fracture on the right, which is a very real possibility at this point. Although I'm not saying it's likely, but it's certainly more of a possibility than it has been in, you know, 25, almost 30 years.
So Social Democrats have a majority government in Canada's third most populous province. The right is in chaos. I think that's a good place to end it. some things to celebrate, some things to be a little bit anxious or concerned about. I'm sure there will be some disappointments from the NDP during their time in government, but I think they are now the only, BC is now the only province in Canada governed by the NDP. And right-wing parties are pretty much in power everywhere else. So I'm at least raising a glass on this occasion. David, thank you for joining us. Where can people find you?
Oh, well, I spend a lot of time hanging around Twitter, not being able to help myself, but I'm on Twitter at David_Mosgrop. I've got a book called Too Dumb for Democracy about political decision making. And I've got a podcast as well called Open to Debate. And they can, folks can find me in any of those places. And I'm always happy to see new people come along.